Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Plotin in Washington, D.C.
But the information that we have is the roadmap that they presented to all stakeholders calls for a new government of consensus to be installed this month, based upon a consensus. And this is different than a national unity government, huh?
Guinea-Bissau's main opposition plans to stick with the ECOWAS political roadmap.
If it happens that what he's saying right now takes place, if everything comes to pass, then it means Chadema is not going to take part in the election. And what that means, well, it will be up for interpretation.
Tanzanian main opposition leader demands electoral reforms before the coming elections. We'll have an analysis.
All public officers to declare their assets, income and liability to the Inspector General of Government. But when we declare it, the spirit is that public servants should be accountable.
And the Inspector General of Government in Uganda calls for a measure to enable the institution to publicly publish the declaration of assets made by top government officials. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Guinea-Bissau, a leading member of the opposition African Party of Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, or PAIGC, says opponents of the administration plan to stick to a roadmap proposed by the regional bloc ECOWAS. This, despite the recent departure of a group the regional bloc sent to Bissau to help resolve the dispute over when presidential and legislative elections are going to be held. Imani Naumoja, a member of the Politburo of the Central Committee of the PAIGC, says President Umaro Sissoko Imbalo's proposal for elections to be held in November violates the Constitution. The president says presidential and legislative polls will be held on November 30. Opponents rejected Imbalo's proposal, saying his term, which began in 2020, had expired. But a Supreme Court ruling says the term will expire on September 4. For more reaction and the latest political development, I reach Imani Naumoja in the Guinea-Bissau capital, Bissau.
Okay, but first of all, it wasn't that the high-level political commission decided to leave. They were chased out. But we want everybody to know that those statements by Omar Sissoko are zero. They're null. Because his term of office ends on the 27th of February. He issued his threats to them on the 1st of March, 2 days later. So it's invalid. But meanwhile, we would like to encourage you to read the public statement by the high-level political mission of ECOWAS and pay close attention to the fact that they issued a roadmap. Now, they don't give the details of the roadmap, but the information that we have is the roadmap that they presented to all the stakeholders calls for a new government of consensus to be installed this month, based upon a consensus. And this is different than a national unity government, huh? This is not that. This is a consensus, which means that the National People's Assembly, which is the legislative body, has its permanent commission. And as the word permanent stresses, under the Constitution of Guinea-Bissau, under no terms can we ever be without a permanent commission. Until you have new elections and the new elected deputies, members of parliament, take their oath of office and among themselves, they elect another permanent commission.
Imbalo announced that the next presidential and parliamentary elections will be held on November 30. What is your party's reaction to this?
Our reaction to that is it's worthless. He doesn't have the authority, even if his term of office did not end. I'm giving a hypothetical example. Even if you have a president, I want to say his name. If you have a president and the president has a 5-year mandate, and in the second year of that mandate or third year of that mandate, if that president unilaterally declares that elections are set for such and such date, it's invalid. According to our system, which is different than places like the U.S. or Senegal, we have a semi-presidential regime where it's the parliamentary system that dominates, similar to like in Cape Verde or Portugal and other places where when you have legislative election, the party that wins enough votes to have enough seats in the parliament where they know they have, where you have at least an absolute majority, then you know you have proof that when you submit your program, the governmental program, and your state budget to the parliament, it'll be passed. In our case, our parliament is called the National People's Assembly. So when you have a president who doesn't like the party that got the most votes, that president has his hands tied, our hands tied. He has to appoint the prime minister from that party. And if the party says, okay, it's going to be Peter or it's going to be Money, it's the party that does that. So if that president unilaterally calls for elections without going through meetings with the, first of all, the permanent commission, the president of the National People's Assembly, the parliament, the permanent commission, and then has to meet with all the parties that have seats in the National People's Assembly, and then has to call a meeting of the Council of State to look at the proposed dates, and also has to meet with the National Electoral Council. But in our case, he just woke up to say, okay, we're going to have elections on the 30th of November.
From what I'm hearing from you about the specific date of when his term of office ends and when the presidential and parliamentary elections will be held, what is your party going to do about this?
Okay, our party has been very clear on that. Not only our party has a coalition and also has a popular front with other parties to have their coalitions. And all of these would represent 90% of the deputies and 90% of the deputies in the National People's Assembly. The position is clear. Number one, we must have elections within 90 days, like the Constitution says. Number two, we will work with ECOWAS because we're part of the ECOWAS community. And fortunately, the ECOWAS political commission that was chased away, in their roadmap, they call for a consensus government this month of March. They call for elections, legislative and presidential, within 90 days. They also call for the National People's Assembly's permanent commission to elect a new electoral council, because the current one has expired, its term of office expired in 2022. And it also calls for the permanent commission to elect a magistrate council for the Supreme Court, so that this magistrate council will hold elections in the Supreme Court to elect a new president. So our party's position with this coalition and the Popular Front is to follow that roadmap traced by the High Commissioner of ECOWAS, to have the consensus government in March, to have elections within 90 days. But as a precondition to have the election, we have to have a new electoral council and a newly elected Supreme Court with a plenary that has a quorum.
Imani Naumoja is a leading member of the opposition African Party of Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde, or PAIGC. He spoke with me from the Guinea-Bissau capital, Bissau. In Gabon, an academic and political analyst says interim President Brice Oligui Nguema's decision to run in the coming April 12th presidential election is not a surprise. Douglas Yates, a professor of African studies at the American Graduate School in Paris, says it's not likely that anyone will defeat the interim president. This after Nguema told his supporters that he plans to run for president. It also comes after the Gabonese Council of Elders recently announced the date for the presidential election following the coup led by General Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema that overthrew longtime President Ali Bongo Ondimba. For more reaction and electoral prospects of the interim president, I reached Professor Douglas Yates.
Ever since Brice Oligui Nguema staged the coup, he's positioned himself to run the country. Now, I need to qualify that because he's been extremely popular ever since overthrowing Ali Bongo and bringing to an end the six decades of Bongo dynasty rule. He enjoyed the benefit of the doubt. It was a largely bloodless coup, for example. This wasn't a huge act of violence like you might see elsewhere. It was a palace coup. He made a civilian government soon after coming to power, which he filled with many competent former civil servants and former prime ministers. And he held a huge popular national dialogue in the spring of last year, in April and May of last year, where he had civil society, including the large church organizations of the country, political parties, and NGOs. participate in making 1,000 recommendations for a new constitution. He held a referendum in November, and the new constitution passed with 92-93%. So he has so far been positioning himself to rule the country, but he's been doing it with broad popular support.
Is it a given, Professor Yates, that looking at his popularity, that he stands to win election?
Yeah, if you had to bet your own money, the best bet would be to bet that he's going to win. But, you know, it's not impossible that they'll have a fair and free election, that he will win. Right now, he's been hard-pressed to really have reasonably powerful opposition leaders oppose him. But that's less his fault than the fault of the system of the dynasty.
I was about to ask you if you would see Jinping this time around challenging military leader Nguema.
Yeah, so Jinping would probably try to act indirectly, but I think he learned his lesson that you don't go up against the powers that be. He barely managed to escape that whole last scenario with his life and a bit of his fortune. So I don't imagine him actually going back into the arena because he's already played this rigged game. And, you know, it's dangerous. It's dangerous for people to do that. So I think he's probably going to act indirectly, try to lend whatever support he can to, you know, a credible opposition. But I don't think he himself will be up there. Also, he had alienated a large numbers of the members of the UN opposition. UN here doesn't mean United Nations, but it was the Union Nationale, the National Union, a coalition of opposition parties. And because after the election was stolen from him, he continued to claim he was president. Bit by bit, the other members of the opposition coalition abandoned him. And so he also wonders whether or not, if he were to present himself, he would manage to get them to give him a second chance. In Gabon, the opposition doesn't tend to like to give their unified opposition candidates a second chance, if only because they'd had some candidates who ran consistently election after election and always lost. The opposition would be interested in winning.
Mm. Nguema told his supporters that after careful consideration and in response to your numerous appeals, I have decided to stand as a candidate in the presidential election. Now, what is your thought on this? Because a lot of political analysts have said that this is typical of dictatorship or populist stance by politicians to take when they seek political office. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so, there are people who see their interest in him taking off his military uniform and becoming the elected president. Some of those, for example, are people who are afraid of the return of the Bongo dynasty because they've put their neck out now. You know, the Bongo dynasty has been driven out of power. The Ali Bongo, you know, under house arrest, only able to travel to get medical treatment. Sylvia Bongo and Nourdine Bongo, the former first lady and the former heir apparent, are under house arrest. And many members of that regime are now, of the Bongo regime, are being held because the government's trying to get the money back. But they're waiting in the wings. If things were to go south for the military junta, the Bongos are fabulously rich, very well connected, and they could come back the way the Marcos family came back in the Philippines.
Douglas Yates is a professor of African studies at the American Graduate School in Paris. He spoke with me from Paris. In Cameroon, the Opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF, has re-elected Joshua Ossi as the group's presidential candidate in the coming general election. At the party's convention in the capital, Yaoundé, delegates unanimously chose Ossi, the SDF's chairman, as the party's candidate. But critics of the party say Ossi, like other opposition leaders, does not have broad national appeal that will pose any significant political threat to the dominance of the ruling party, Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM. For more about the chances of the SDS presidential candidate in the coming elections, I reached Richard Indifo. He is the SDF Secretary for Political Education and Training.
Mr. Osi is a dedicated leader with a strong track record in social democracy. And we believe that he is the right person to lead us into the future. So during the convention, we also launched our political program, which focused on key issues such as the political transition in Cameroon, where we hope to rebuild the political institutions in Cameroon and ensure that we prioritize real democracy, genuine democracy for Cameroon.
Some people are suggesting that last time he challenged President Paul Biya, he didn't perform that well. What makes you, or what makes the party so confident to re-elect him to lead your party in the coming presidential contest?
Yeah, the people who make those statements do not factor a number of things. In the last presidential elections, we suffered from the crisis, the political crisis in the Northwest and Southwest region, that two English-speaking region, which is the base, the stronghold of the SDF. And so in the last election, people from this region were not able to go out and vote. And that is what affected Mr. Osi's performance in the last presidential election. We still believe that he is a strong candidate, and that given the current situation, knowing fully aware that the crisis, though not it has not ended, but at least it has stabilized in a way that people can freely go out and vote in these two regions. And so we are confident that he is the best candidate for not only for our party, but for Cameroon as a whole.
Some are suggesting that the opposition political parties are too many, you are too divided, that makes it easy for incumbent President Paul Biya and his ruling CPDM to easily win the election. And they are saying without coming together to form an alliance with a single presidential candidate, your chances of winning are slim to nothing. How do you respond to that?
First of all, let me correct to say that many of those posturing to be candidates for the presidential election may not be eligible to be presidential candidate because we know that the conditions for being a presidential candidate is not as easy as many people think, because first of all, you need to have a political party that has at least an elected representative who can nominate you, failing which you need 300 signatories, 30 from each region, and most especially has to come from CPDM elected or nominated or officials, appointed officials, and it becomes very difficult for you to get that, for you to be probably an independent candidate. That notwithstanding, the SDF has always been open to building alliances, to work with other political parties, to build a formidable coalition to challenge the president, the current regime. We are still working on that.
Politics is about numbers, as they say. Is the SDF attractive enough and has the political groundswell support enough to attract other political parties to help or boost the chances of your presidential candidate?
Well, as it stands now, the SDF is the most credible political party with what it takes to nominate a candidate. We are represented in all the divisions and subdivisions and all the regions of the country, and we are found in all the crooks and crannies of Cameroon. If you go even to the most remote area of Cameroon and mention the SDF, they will be able to identify that. And we have militants, we have structures in all the part of Cameroon. And so therefore, we stand a better chance to win this election. And we hope that many other opposition parties are going to see that we have what it takes to win the election more than any other political party. However, it is, like you said, getting into a coalition is all about negotiation. It's a negotiation. And so if there is another political party that thinks that they are strong enough, we are ready to talk with them.
Richard Ndifo is the SDF Secretary for Political Education and Training. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. A Tunisian lawyer and analyst says there's no guarantee that prominent opposition figures accused of security offenses will receive a fair trial. Osama Helal, who is also a former law lecturer, says it appears the charges are politically motivated to clamp down on the opposition. His remarks come as the trial of 40 high-profile opponents of the administration began in the capital, Tunis, on Tuesday. Charges they face include, quote, plotting against the state security and belonging to a terrorist group. But lawyers for the accused told the French news agency AFP that there is no evidence that justifies a plot against state security. For more reaction and analysis of the latest development, I reached Osama Helal.
Let me start by stating some legal facts. Is that even the legislator, whenever he enacted these texts, he didn't deny the political character or characterization of these cases. So yeah, it's highly political, and even in the text, it's said to be a political type offenses or political type of crimes, and I do prefer to use the term crimes, because we're facing 5 years and even death penalty, heavy penalties for each and every one of the accused in this case.
Is this politically motivated, or are there factual crimes they committed for which reason they are facing this trial?
Absolutely not. And even more, which is very sad for a leading country such as Tunisia in the Arab Spring movement, and also for reforms of the judicial system, to have back some trials of this kind. It was based on a hearing of a witness nobody knows, and who didn't even see or hear from the accusee. It was just a hearing from someone telling someone, and tells could not represent facts to base on such a heavy trial like this one. The inquiries led by the authorities are absent. No inquiry was conducted by the authorities to check the witnesses were saying the truth. No hearings were made for a lot of the persons accused in this in case.
You know, they faced serious charges, including plotting against the state security and belonging to a terrorist group, which under Tunisian law could attract the death penalty. What do you make of this?
As a Tunisian lawyer, and every student of law in Tunisia would tell you the same thing, plot against the national security. If we characterize what these person did as a plot against the national security, it would be the first one to be tried would be the president himself, having some contact with foreign embassies, and some countries were cited in this case officially as having discussed with the opposition the possibility to commit a plot against the president. So it's really a fantasy. Yeah, it's not even based on real facts. No letters. No official meetings. Just having met an officer of the U.S. embassy, for instance, was considered as an act of plot against the national security for one of the accusee in this case.
Critics of the opposition are saying that they will receive a fair trial in Tunisia, and that if they are not guilty, they will not be found guilty, and that they are not above the law. What do you say to that?
We've been following trials since 2 years. We have lawyers in prison. We have journalists in prison. We have cyber activists in prison. And there was no due process of law. There was no respect of any kind of a minima of guarantees of defense. We cannot say that they will have or benefit of a fair trial, since these persons were not even allowed to attend their trial. They are in prison still today, and the authorities have made the choice to conduct a trial online through the Zoom platform.
Osama Helal is a Tunisian lawyer and analyst. He spoke with me from Paris, France. A Tanzanian political analyst says it is not likely demands by main opposition party Chadema for electoral reforms will be met before the coming general election. Ansbert Ngurumo also says it appears the call is a negotiating tactic by the opposition to pressure the government into carrying out reforms to ensure transparent and accountable elections. This after intensified calls by Tundu Lissu, the newly elected chairman of Chadema, for electoral reforms. At a recent meeting with Tanzanian journalists, the opposition figure says the party maintains its stance that there would be no elections without changes, saying, no reform, no election. But critics dismiss the demand, saying it is not realistic. They also say the ruling CCM does not appear to be interested in the opposition party's demands. For the latest political development, I reach political analyst Ansbert Ngurumo.
First of all, I don't think it is his statement. The no reforms, no election slogan or statement is not his. It is his party's statement that was reached after the consultation among themselves within the party organ. I think they came up with that statement after the Central Committee meeting some time ago. So it is not his position, like his individual position. The thing is, what is at stake is the interpretation, which is now seemingly ambiguous when it comes to the public domain. And if you ask me, the way I understand it, it's a strategy for negotiation, demand for electoral reforms, the significant changes in the electoral system before election. I also see it as a call for systemic change, I mean, in the legal and constitutional amendments regarding the constitution, I mean, regarding the election and the electoral system. You can also look at it as a protest against a rigged election. A major concern that comes up after he has made his statement about what they mean, like they are ready to make sure there is no election that is going to take place. That is where the ambiguity comes from, and the vagueness that is causing a lot of misinterpretation, misinformation, and a lot of argumentation and disagreement about what is happening. So if it happens that what he's saying right now takes place, if everything comes to pass, then it means Chadema is not going to take part in the election. And what that means, well, it will be up for interpretation.
You have interacted with a lot of Tanzanians. You are a Tanzanian yourself. But how are people reacting to this on the ground? Because the question is, if the status quo remains, the biggest party, CCM, that has dominated Tanzania's political landscape since independence will carry the day. But why would they allow the landscape to change when it will not favor them? Some argue. What are your thoughts?
This statement brings a divided opinion in a divided society. And apparently, I'm also seeing a divided opinion within the same party. There is no question that we need changes in the electoral system. There's no question about the constitution amendments that we need. And we all know that the government has always been nonchalant or indifferent about the changes that are demanded by the people. But what I'm seeing right now is like the opposition is being trapped or is trapping itself into this situation. I'm not seeing any political will from the point of view of the ruling party and the government. But I'm seeing some loss of hope on the part of the opposition, because they don't see any light at the end of the tunnel, and they think this is the only way, the only, and then I mean the last option they are making. And in my eyes, it's not pragmatic, it's not really feasible, it is not realistic. But anything is possible. Maybe this is an opportunity for them to prove themselves and to prove others wrong. They may need to do further consultation. They may need to do serious engagement. But I'm seeing something that I cannot clearly construe when it comes to what they are telling the people. And the people are speaking the same language that I'm speaking. There are people who say it is possible, and there are others who say it is not possible. So it's up to them to prove others wrong.
Ansbert Ngurumo is a Tanzanian political analyst. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The Inspector General of Government in Uganda is calling for a constitutional amendment to enable the institution to publicly publish the declaration of assets made by top government officials. Betty Kamia also says the new measure will give Ugandans clear oversight and the information regarding the fight against corruption. It comes as civil society and anti-graft activists demand a new measure to make officials reveal to the public their assets and earnings to ensure transparency and accountability. For more on the call for new legal provisions in the fight against corruption, I reach Betty Kamia, the Inspector General of Government in Uganda.
Yes, you see, we have in our legislation a requirement for all public officers to declare their assets, income, and liability to the Inspector General of Government. But when we declare it, the spirit is that public servants should be accountable to the public about their conduct, especially in management of public resources. So if the public do not know what you have declared and what you have not declared, because I think that most people declare some and not everything they own, or they don't declare the right values, I think it would support the principle of transparency if we strengthened the law by requiring that declarations be made public.
Madam Kamia, some people are suggesting that they are surprised that the issue of transparency hasn't been tackled by lawmakers or the authorities as yet, because transparency is part of the effort to clamp down or root out corruption in any jurisdiction.
No. They have tackled it, but it can always be improved. You know, it's always work in progress. Perfection is work in progress. So even to legislate a declaration of assets is a step towards transparency. And if we've not got to the end of the road, it is still work in progress. So what I'm recommending is an extra mile on the same route.
So do you think such a law or legislation or measure, for that matter, would enhance citizens' oversight by enabling them to monitor their leaders' wealth?
Yeah, absolutely. The more information there is, the better decisions are made. The more information available to people, the more active they can operate. So it's just enhancing people's access to information. Even now, they can ask for that information and it will be available to them, but the process is expensive and tedious.
Is the Inspector General of Government, IGG, engage these lawmakers so they will put forth such a motion in the legislature?
Not yet. It's just a thought. But it's not just my thought. It has been, there are sections of society that are already pushing for it. So I'm just considering that there are sections of society, especially civil society, and other individuals that are already pushing for it. So it's a thought, and I think that we should move it forward.
Some civil society and anti-corruption activists I have spoken to said there's need for you to expedite action by engaging these lawmakers to ensure this thought
really comes into fruition to ensure that the fight against corruption is won, not only by effectively having the IGG do its oversight work, but that the people of Uganda will get the benefit. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. The war against corruption must be stepped up in any sector, any sphere, any stone that can be unturned to advance the war should be used. But this is just one small step, but there are lots of other things that could be done.
How soon will the IGG begin approaching these lawmakers to put into action this thought that you have?
Oh, yeah. It has to go through a lot of consultations internally, and then we get on other people on board. By the time it gets to Parliament, it will be quite... You need a bit of consultation. And as I said, I'm just picking up from what sections of the public are demanding, and then we have to do quite a bit of a consultation. And in any case, we are in the process as a country of proposing a constitutional or law reforms or constitutional amendment. So this could be one of them. This is could be one. The timing is just perfect to propose this one.
Betty Kamya is the Inspector General of Government in Uganda. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Still in Uganda, parliamentarian Jimmy Akena says he is prepared to sacrifice his life to ensure there is a change in government in the next general election. Akena, who is also the leader of the opposition Uganda People's Congress, or UPC, also rejected criticisms that he poses no significant political threat to incumbent President Yoweri Museveni and his ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM. At a recent meeting with fishermen, Akena, who is the son of former Ugandan President Milton Obote, says he is ready to sacrifice everything to see political change in Uganda. But his critics say he is yet another politician trying to stay relevant ahead of the general election. For more insight into his plans to win political power, I reach parliamentarian Jimmy Akena.
Of recent, we have had a situation whereby the army is policing the lakes and trying to secure fish for export, while the communities which live by the lakes, which have subsisted on the lake, are having to find their own means, and there's a rise in malnutrition and all sorts of around this because people depend upon the lake. So I was making it very clear that such sort of issues which do not work in the interest of the citizens of Uganda were not going to be acceptable, and we are ready to take up the challenge to make sure that the citizens of Uganda have the benefits of being citizens and also enjoy the rights as enshrined in the universal documents, like Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Let them also have those rights to be able to live and raise their families in peace and comfort.
But you are saying that you are willing to even join your father. That means to even die for the cause of political change. Are you committed to this statement, or this is just a political talk?
It is not a political talk. This is a serious statement. And considering I live in a country whereby they are the leaders and the generals who believe that the issues such as fundamental human rights can be determined by the leadership or the high command of the army. So it is not a light statement you make in a circumstance where you live in those situations. And that of recent, of course, I'm sure you must have been following, there's this desire to have cases of sometimes of political nature prosecuted in a military court, and where that court is really under strict orders to come up with a particular outcome. So I don't make such statements lightly. I know the terrain I'm living in, and I also know what is at stake. So I made those statements knowing full well the repercussions or the content therein.
Mr. Akena, some of your critics are saying, what do you know about suffering? You were born and or raised with a silver spoon in your mouth. You don't know the suffering of the people. You are also a member of parliament leading the UPC party, challenging President Museveni on several occasions. You really don't know what affects the people of Uganda. So you should not be the one talking like that, they argue. What's your response to that?
I have spent 29 years as a refugee, and let nobody tell you, whatever circumstances, refugee life is not something I'll recommend for anybody. And at the same time, because of those upheavals, I've had my whole world turned upside down on two occasions. And therefore, I'm conversant. I've also worked with the communities who have been displaced, who have gone through suffering. And I think from the time I entered politics in Uganda, my first order of business was how to get the millions of displaced Uganda citizens back to their homes, which involved a peace process, which I was glad to be a part of, and took us deep in the jungles of Congo to try and see whether Joseph Kony was willing to get to the table, which he did. And at least we got some level of disengagement, which allowed people to go home. So, yes, I know what the suffering is, and I think I'm in a position to be able to pronounce myself on that.
Ms. Akena, you also said you want to enter State House through the forthcoming elections. But as it stands now, some people are saying you are just one of the many opposition political parties, and that because of your number, it makes it possible or easy for President Yoweri Museveni and his NRM party to win elections easily. Are you willing to form an alliance, or you want to go it alone?
As a student of mathematics, when you have a formula for presidential, which is a 50+1 vote, that one should clearly spell out that any percentage matters. And if you look at the last vote, what was officially declared may not be exactly what took place, what transpired, but it gives you a working figure. And considering the fact that the president alleges that 1 million votes were stuffed in the last general elections, which roughly comes out to about 10% of the vote. So 1 million vote can actually deny any candidate the 50+1. So I don't think that it's somebody who's really serious about the politics or really understands the politics or the rules in this particular case, which is 50+1. If it is first past the post, then it definitely makes sense that it's better that we sit down and try to balance ourselves such that we get a candidate first past the post. But we're running a 50+1 system. The 50+1 system gives different dynamics. And I'd like to encourage any candidate who believes they have an actual support base to offer themselves as a candidate. The first round, if we come to the second round, the first round we'd like to determine where the chips fall, and therefore we respond thereafter.
Parliamentarian Jimmy Akena is leader of the opposition Uganda People's Congress, or UPC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up, the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Temptation and doubt is a way to keep us from finding a paradise no more hiding. I can never do it on my own, cause I will never heal from this pain. I can never do it on my own, cause I will never heal from this pain.
I really need, I really need time. my dreadlocks are longer. I know say right now, not my time, I no go waste them rara. I go use them dada, I go use them dada. You know say Nessie in a bastard. How do you see Pam Cheche? So if I do you wrong, I apologize. For the people who they sympathize, I got go make them larger. Follow snakes and spiders. Make a wrong move, lose your life. Make it hard for your mother to sleep at night. Street no love you, right? Some people they for mortuary. Some people they for hospital too. Count your blessing one by one. Sure bet, yeah, time has come to lift our voices. Lift my voice in prayer.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nylon Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mugbeal Yabaru, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the foreigner has big eyes but cannot see. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.